First case is number 25-1256, United States of America against Carlos Alberto Gascon Concepcion. Mr. Campbell.
Good morning, Your Honors. Matt Campbell, Federal Public Defender for the District of the Virgin Islands on behalf of Carlos Gascon Concepcion, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honors, this is a rather straightforward single issue case. As the court's aware, I've withdrawn the first issue, which was phrased as the first and second issue in the government's briefing, and we're proceeding simply on the jury instructional issue. So it is a straightforward issue of whether the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Gascon's request for a simple possession instruction, a lesser included offense. And frankly, I don't believe that the parties have significant legal disputes as to what the controlling law is. There is no doubt that simple possession is a lesser included offense of possession with intent to distribute cocaine. We believe here that the district court did abuse its discretion by effectively granting summary judgment to the government based on DEA Special Agent Pitaluga's testimony.
Now, do you agree on the legal standard?
I'm sorry?
Do you think you agree on the legal standard as well?
For when?
When a simple possession instruction is warranted or appropriate.
I believe we do, Your Honor. I think the law is relatively clear that a defendant is entitled to a lesser included offense instruction when sufficient evidence exists for a reasonable jury to find guilty of the lesser and acquit on the greater. It's sometimes stated that the instruction is appropriate if a jury could rationally find the defendant guilty of the lesser and acquit on the greater.
All right. So, and that's what we said in the panel, not precedential opinion in Vacquez, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, so you're not taking issue with that standard. We're dealing with application of
precisely
to law. Okay, go ahead.
And I think both the parties had decided the court's opinion in Knight for the rational jury standard.
The kinds of things that a judge can consider. You wouldn't dispute the judge can consider the quantity of the cocaine, correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And
you dispute that the judge can consider the purity of the cocaine.
I think the judge can consider the purity of the cocaine.
The judge can consider the packaging of the cocaine.
I think the judge can consider that, yes.
The Psycho Bunny logo, the brick, those kinds of things here. The judge can consider whether or not he's a cocaine user, whether he's a cocaine addict.
Of course.
All right. Well, the judge, you know, the judge can consider that your client said he was visiting family here, but didn't have the usual luggage.
Your Honor, I believe that to be true. However, I think in this case, that factor is a very limited application because clearly.
But the district court considered all of these factors.
And you've admitted that they're legally appropriate to consider. I think that's correct, that the district court considered them, and they are factors that the court can consider. However, I think the court misapplied those factors.
Do we review that application for abuse of discretion?
Yes.
Okay. Why was the abuse of discretion here?
Yes. Well, the abuse of discretion, I believe, comes from two parts. First of all, the jury was entitled to disbelieve every word that Agent Pitaluga said. And the jury was, in fact, instructed, according to the standard instructions on experts, that they could disbelieve every word out of his mouth. The defense had cross-examined Agent Pitaluga extensively about his limited experience in the Virgin Islands. His testimony was based on just usual experiences, not specific experiences to this case. He had no involvement or knowledge about this case. He only spoke of general tendencies. And the jury was told, it is up to you to decide whether to give significant weight, some weight, or no weight to his testimony, as well as the testimony of the chemist who also testified regarding the purity and the like. The jury was also entitled to credit the testimony of Mr. Gascon's father, who testified that Mr. Gascon started using drugs at age 14, that he used drugs daily, that he was taken to treatment in Chicago but escaped, that he used drugs constantly as an adult.
Drugs were marijuana, not cocaine, correct?
That was the specific substance that the father mentioned was marijuana.
Okay.
But
we're trying to figure out whether this is a simple possession or possession with intent to distribute. And so it's going to matter that the drug that he had used and was in treatment for was not the same drug that he was charged with this time.
That is certainly a factor that could be considered.
However, put another way, if the son had a problem of cocaine addiction, father would have testified to that, and it would have helped his case, at least helped his argument that he was a user rather than a trafficker.
I would concede that that would have been a stronger case, but
and there's no evidence at all that he used cocaine.
There is no direct evidence that he used cocaine. However,
is there indirect evidence that he used cocaine?
Well, I would say two things for that. I think it's common knowledge that marijuana is a gateway drug and often leads to other usage. I think also, was it sort of an opposite scenario where we were challenging sufficiency of the evidence? The government frequently argues reasonable inferences. I think the jury would be entitled, based on the father's testimony about a 30-plus year drug history, erratic behavior caused by drugs, that he often used drugs with friends, et cetera.
All right. I think that makes a lot of sense if he had had an eight ball or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Then he looks like a guy who came to the islands to use cocaine or buy a little cocaine in St. Thomas to bring it back to use in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
So does this case really come down to the quantity then? Is that the rub here? I mean, maybe Mr. Sleeper won't agree with me that if it were, you know, a small quantity, it sure looks like at least a reasonable juror could conclude it was for personal use.
Your Honor, I'm not going to argue that quantity is irrelevant, nor am I arguing that there needs to be a rule that every time possession with intent is charged, there has to be a lesser included offense. But I think we need to distinguish this case, which admittedly has 1 kilo, from other cases. And I can think of a case that Attorney Sleeper and I argued in front of this court that had 270 kilos in.
You would have a really tough argument if it were 270 kilos.
I would agree. And I was the trial lawyer. We didn't make that argument in that case. I would also agree that frequently we get MDLEA cases with bales and bales of marijuana. I'm not arguing for a broad rule. But what I am arguing here, if we look back to Agent Pitaluga's testimony, the 1 kilogram, when broken down to what a heavy user would use, could be consumed in 100 days. And Agent Pitaluga also testified that it is dangerous to buy drugs because the drug community can be a dangerous community. You can also get caught. Moreover, there was a fair amount of testimony about the cost. And whereas buying a 1 kilo brick, the estimate was $10,000. If one ended up buying 1 kilogram in eight balls or the like, it would cost something like $42,000. So there are a lot of reasons why buying in bulk for a heavy user makes sense. It's safer, less likely to get caught with repeated buys, and you save money. Now, I understand there was this testimony about the purity levels. Well, it is also a reasonable inference that a user would rather be using pure cocaine than cut cocaine. The less it's cut, the better the high, and it's less dangerous. Cocaine can be cut with fentanyl, and that can kill you. So the fact that there's a purity issue here does not show that it necessarily was for distribution. Agent Pitaluga never said people don't use 85% pure. And common sense says that's what a user wants because it gets a better high. So that testimony, again, the jury was entitled to draw reasonable inferences from the testimony. And
you're saying the district judge was unreasonable then in saying, when I see a kilo brick of cocaine, very pure, wrapped up, that looks like dealer amount quantity packaging, et cetera, rather than user. You're saying the district judge was unreasonable.
What I'm saying the district court was unreasonable, what I'm saying the district court was unreasonable to essentially say that no rational jury could conclude otherwise. That's what I'm saying. I think it's possible that two conclusions on any set of facts can be reasonable. But what I'm saying is it was an abuse of discretion to say that no reasonable jury or no rational jury could possibly discredit Agent Pitaluga's testimony, credit the father's testimony, and draw inferences in Mr. Gaskett's favor. I see I'm out of time. If the court has questions,
we'll hear you on rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Mr. Sleeper.
Good morning, Your Honors. Adam Sleeper for the United States. Welcome back. Thank you. I want to emphasize here that we are under abuse of discretion review. That's a very high burden for my friend on the other side to overcome. We're also dealing with a kilogram quantity of cocaine. When we look at comparable amounts of cocaine being challenged, courts have relied on amounts similar to that amount.
How many days or weeks would it take a typical cocaine user to use a kilo of 85% pure?
Well, there was that 100 days testimony out there.
Oh, I guess.
Right? If that was that would be a very heavy user. If you look at the rest of Agent Pitaluga's testimony, certainly he is not testifying that people actually use that much cocaine every day, and that would be for 100 days straight. I think the other thing, and while we really think that the quantity alone would be enough to get us where we are in this case, even if we look at the testimony of the father is saying that, his son uses drugs and can't even pay his rent because he's buying drugs. And the defense theory would have us believe that this person that is so addicted to drugs that he can't pay his rent is saving up $10,000 to be able to buy a kilo of cocaine.
Are you arguing that the only rational inference is that it was obtained on consignment?
I think that's the reasonable inference, Your Honor. If this person can't afford his rent, I don't think there's any reason to believe that an addict like is being argued in this case, on the briefs, is someone that would be able to set up the scenario that we have here. But I also do want to address some of the other testimony because we didn't.
Before you do that, you said a minute ago that you thought that the quantity alone is enough. If you're serious about that, I'm going to just explore that for a moment. So if we're at 1 kilogram, at what point would the quantity alone not be enough?
Start with the 8-ball. Wouldn't you concede that if it's an 8-ball, there has to be a simple possession instruction?
I would absolutely.
All right. So this is work up.
If that's relying solely on quantity, there could obviously be other evidence out there showing that.
I get it. But you sort of invited that by saying quantity alone is enough. So I'm just curious to know, in the future, if we have a case where there aren't many other facts, but we have a quantity, interesting quantity issue, where would we draw the line? Where would you want to draw the line?
Where we are on the exact spectrum is difficult. Certainly I think I could concede the 8-ball. Going up from there, I think different courts, I think, across the country have sort of drawn that exact line
that we would draw it. If we're trying to figure out the highest, actually, we want to figure out a safe harbor for. If you're saying a kilo is automatically enough, is half a kilo automatically enough, is 100 grams automatically enough?
I certainly understand the court's interest in that question. I'm not sure that I can set an exact point and say, the United States says at this point, a distribution quantity versus not. First of all, it's not going to be a case there's going to be the rare case where the evidence is going to be quantity. You know, there's always going to be surrounding.
Well, but that seems to undermine your argument that quantity is enough. If we're always going to look at the totality of the circumstances, should we even try to just exclusively say quantity?
Well, so let me say this. So if we look at Cotton out of the Sixth and Castro out of the Ninth, they said this amount is enough. And that was 1.5 and a little under two. Now, what I don't think was presented in those cases, like let's say if my friend on the other side had called as a witness, a friend of the defendant who had said, you know, I know that he travels once a year. You know, I've traveled over with him once a year. He travels to St. Thomas. He buys a kilo of cocaine. He uses that, you know, over the course of the year for solely personal use. And I know this and I've seen this. That's immensely unlikely. And there's a reason that that testimony didn't come out at this trial. But hypothetically, there could be other evidence that could undermine the quantity. Well, I guess what I'm saying is
that's the Costco example.
Correct.
If someone is really a value shopper and they're not afraid of the incarceration risk that comes with carrying around a kilo of cocaine, it is certainly cost efficient to go buy 1 kilo rather than do 50 drug deals.
Right. And that's an.
But you would have to be a foundation laid.
Right. It's an immensely unlikely scenario. So there would need to be some evidence getting us to that point.
Oh, but all that also seems to suggest it's the totality that this court and the district courts should be looking at all the facts and then try to make a decision answering that question. Could a rational jury find that this was for personal use?
Absolutely. And maybe I should rephrase what I was saying, because I'm not contending that you look at the quantity and that's the one factor. What I'm saying is you've got a sliding scale of evidence here. If you have one of those factors, like the amount that is so high.
Then if we had 200 kilograms, maybe you wouldn't need any other facts.
Right. Well, I mean, and maybe you could conceive of someone coming in with some test. You know, I can't really conceive what that would be, but certainly they'd be entitled to put it on. And if there was evidence from which someone could draw that, well, maybe. But I think once we hit around the 1 kilogram quantity, you know, what I'm looking at and as I'm putting these cases together is, you know, unless there's something really persuasive to show, you know, you can just look at the quantity and say that's enough. You know, and what I would say is, as you move down the quantity, you know, other testimony could also get you there. For example, if we're looking at the Puckett case out of the Seventh Circuit, that was only 63 grams, but they put on expert testimony like we put on here, talking about the number of days that this would be needed for personal use, you know, discussing the same sort of expert testimony that we put on. Now, there was also a prior conviction for possession with intent to distribute crack there. So that was, you know, also another factor bolstering that.
Earlier, we were talking about, I guess, hypothetical situations where a user might buy a kilogram to use over 100 days. Is there any evidence in the record that users actually do that? They buy a kilogram for personal use?
No, I think that was the extremely conservative number that you know, Agent Pitaluga was talking about when he was actually talking about what people were using. It was not 10 grams a day. And there was also evidence in there regarding branding, regarding packaging.
I remember.
You know, we hit a lot of the bases that the jury is instructed to consider here. And really, the only counteracting evidence was that this defendant uses drugs, has used drugs since he was a child. The only specific drug that was mentioned was marijuana. In fact, he was found with some small amount of green leafy substance on him while he was.
I'm not sure how the packaging helps you. Isn't it true that the worst prototype of street level addicts are very brand sensitive and focus on getting the stuff that they rely on?
I don't know that there's any evidence about that in this record here, Your Honor. I guess what I would also say
is common knowledge, isn't it? I mean,
Does the judge need evidence? What can the judge notice of? I mean, the quantity, packaging, because are we going to turn these into?
I'm sorry, when you say this, you mean the instruction?
I understand. When the judge is trying to figure out what a rational jury could find, does the judge need to have testimony or expert reports or affidavits about, you know, quantities of typical use or packaging or things? At what point can the judge take judicial notice of these matters? Because going to be doing this stuff pre-trial, does the judge need to have a hearing with evidence before the judge says, I'm not giving this lesser included offense instruction? Because right now, you know, I'm trying to understand how much the judge has before we get accused, the judge gets accused of like usurping the jury's province or weighing the evidence or something like that.
Well, Judge, I think what needs to be considered is what the jury could consider. So in some ways that does require looking at the evidence. I know at least the practice in this court has generally been, we fight out the jury instructions after, you know, the evidence has come in. You know, certainly this is something that might be able to be done on proffer prior to, but the fundamental inquiry is what a rational jury would.
For the most part, the parties are not going to know until the charging conference at the end whether or not this is happening. You're not suggesting there's some things that are so clear that we can go into trial and say, this boat had 200 kilos on it. There's no way I'm giving a lesser included offense instruction no matter what. You're nodding at this, but there are going to be some downsides to this in terms of the parties planning their presentations and their openings and other things if this all has to wait until the charging conference at the end, because maybe there are some thresholds at which the judge can make this ruling pre-trial.
Well, you know, I guess I'm not saying it couldn't be done pre-trial. I don't know that the pre-trial determination would be the final determination. I think I could conceive of a situation where a motion in limine is filed, where the where the parties proceed by proffer as a way of, you know, sounding out this issue. Of course, then at trial, if those proffers don't play out, you know, there could very well be something different.
That might be a good approach, but just in terms of how we think about writing this stuff and giving guidance to district courts, it would be helpful to think through what if it's a matter of law, what if it is like proffers as to what will ultimately be proved up, and what if it has to wait until the charging conference at the end?
Understood, Your Honor. But I do think fundamentally what the judge is doing here is saying, based on the evidence and based on the reasonable inferences that a jury could draw, could a rational jury make this find not guilty on the greater and guilty on the lesser? And fundamentally, that's an evidentiary inquiry.
Is a rational jury 12 rational people, or is it 10 rational people and 2 not so rational people?
Your Honor, if I may, is your question whether it would be enough for a rational jury?
Well, I was going to ask Mr. Campbell that, but I thought I'd try it on you first. I think it makes a difference, right?
So,
because if I'm in Mr. Campbell's shoes, I'm hoping I've got, and if I'm in Mr. Campbell's shoes and I think that a kilo sure looks like something other than simple possession, then I'm hoping that I've got a couple of people on the jury that are just sort of,
and we need one.
Clueless. Yeah, I just need one on the jury who's just sort of clueless. And if I've got 11 rational people and one clueless people, I got a hung jury.
So I understand what the court is saying. I think when we conceive of what a rational jury is, we don't conceive of it as a spectrum where there might be one juror who's one way, one juror who's another. We think of it as 12 rational jurors. And here, I don't think that we hypothesize the potential juror who might have not been rational, but would have gone for this anyway. I don't know if that's, you know, I think we're looking at each of these jurors as rational jurors and assuming that all of them are rational rather than looking at a spectrum of potential jurors that could result in a mistrial. Does that answer the court's question? Unless the court has any further questions for me, I would just ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Sleeper. Mr. Campbell, could I ask you to start where we left off there about what is a rational jury?
Yes. I think a rational jury is 12 jurors who make it through jury selection. I think that
12 jurors who make it through jury selection.
Correct.
Yeah. So this is a big difference between 12 rational people.
Yes. I think it's 12 jurors who make it through jury selection. And I think our system presumes.
What guarantees that everyone who makes it through is rational?
Well, I think that is the wisdom of our system, that we don't have a test at the beginning to see whether somebody's beliefs and somebody's mindset fits a certain paradigm.
I think what you're saying in some ways reflects the real world, in the sense that if you put 12 people in the box in a case like this, some people are going to know right away what a kilogram of cocaine is. They're going to know what a kilogram is. Other people aren't even going to know what the word kilogram represents in terms of weight or shape or size. How could we accept your invitation to make that the legal rule? If we did that, then aren't we saying everything goes to the jury? What is the judge's role as gatekeeper? Is there any role as judge for judge as gatekeeper if we accept your notion of what a rational jury is?
Your Honor, I think there is. And I think there's several things that would guide decision-making in this area. And there was some discussion about where's the line that, you know, a kilogram, half a kilogram, quarter, like that kind of thing. I don't think a court can set a line in that regard.
About 100 kilograms, would that be a line?
Your Honor, I think that would be a very difficult case for a defense team to make. But what I think is important to recognize here in this case.
Even at 100 kilograms, it should go to the jury on the lesser included charge.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, I think the standard should be look at the totality of circumstances of a case. Now, 1,000 kilograms of cocaine is going to be a very strong factor that is going to weigh against the defense from saying 1,000 kilograms is for personal use. But I think the standard needs to be totality of the circumstances.
And all right, let's stipulate to that. That makes perfect sense. But let's parse out the rational jury a little more. Let's assume you put 12 in a box, and I'm correct that people know what a kilogram is and other people have no idea what it is.
Sure.
If we accept that it's the 12 people that make it into the box, we're taking away what happens at trial, right? Because even someone who's a neophyte who has no idea what a kilogram is, doesn't know the difference between the metric system and our system, during the course of the trial, the point of the presentation is to educate the jury about these things, right? Mm-hmm. So if the only testimony in the case is that this quantity is so large that it's trafficking quantity, not use quantity, is it rational for one of the jurors to go in the room and say, oh, I don't know, I saw Scarface, you know, I saw Scarface and that, you know, that guy put a brick out there and Al Pacino had on his table, like it looked like a brick and he snorted all that in 2 days. So, you know, sure. Is that a rational juror?
Well, again, I think we have to look to the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, defense counsel extensively cross-examined Agent Pitaluga about his qualifications and about the conclusions that he drew from his experience. So I think it would be a different situation, for example, if Agent Pitaluga got up on the stand, said what he said on direct, and defense said no questions. So
What if they had no expert testimony?
If they had no expert
testimony, couldn't the court still have taken this away from the jury by saying, on these facts, short trip, suitcase with hardly anything in it, kilo, pure, no evidence of use, personal use, on these facts, regardless of Agent Petoluca, I'm not sending this to the jury on simple possession.
So if we assume that Agent Petoluca never testifies, the rest of the testimony is the same.
What I hear you saying is that, and there's intuitive appeal to it, it's not the judge's province to decide whether Petoluca is a credible witness or a good witness or what he's saying makes sense.
Correct.
Okay.
And
that's an intuitive appeal, but isn't it also true that the judge would have to be completely blind to the presentation of evidence to not take notice of short trip, suitcase, hardly anything in it, kilo of cocaine, et cetera?
I think if Agent Petoluca had not testified, the judge absolutely could not refuse a lesser included offense instruction. I think that the factors Your Honor has just mentioned would be factors that the government could argue in closing argument to the jury for inferences. But if there is no testimony in Agent Petoluca's experience, how much is a user versus how much is a dealer, I don't see how a judge could possibly use knowledge from outside, from other cases, to conclude that it's not rational.
All right, so the judge couldn't take judicial notice that a kilo is an outlandish amount of cocaine to use on one or two or 25 nights.
I don't think a judge could take judicial notice of that to preclude an instruction. Okay. If there's no testimony. I did have a couple of quick points, if the court would allow.
If all 12 jurors are by definition irrational, I don't know how a judge could never not send everything to the jury. He could never say a rational juror would never find that lesser included charge, because by your definition, every juror is rational. And if you don't know until you give it to them. So you got to give it to the jury and see what they do.
Your Honor, I am not asking for that ruling, because I think that there could be circumstances in hypotheticals where the only conclusion is either possession with intent to distribute or not. Yeah. And I'll just give you a very quick potential hypothetical. 1,000 kilograms. The defendant goes to a buy site where the undercover DEA agent is going to buy the 1,000 kilograms. There's video of the whole thing, and the cell phones show 2 weeks of communications to set up that buy. And undisputed evidence that the defendant has never used drugs a day in his life. I think that will be a very difficult case. I think totality of circumstances, I think no rational jury based on the jury instructions and the testimony could possibly make that argument. But that's not what we have here. The last points that I did want to make is, I think it's important to remember, there was no what I would call affirmative evidence of distribution. There is no buyer. There is no communications. There's nothing like that. So we're talking about a case that's all inferences. That's what this case is about. And in regard to matters like packaging and the branding and that sort of thing, the government is using an if A then B, that means if B then A. The fact that distributors use packaging does not mean that packaging equals distribution. It's just logically not true. And that's the rationale that the government repeatedly uses here.
Just ask one fact question. If he were just using, he could get his cocaine in Puerto Rico. What's the explanation for why he would travel here to get with a large empty suitcase to get a kilogram of cocaine?
Your Honor, I will candidly state that issue was not factually brought out at trial, you know, what the reason was to come to St. Thomas. But one can come up with potential reasons. Yeah. Perhaps he knew somebody here who had that amount and was willing to sell it at a good price. But we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't have the answer to that. Last point I'll make is this was particularly prejudicial. There was the conversation about could you decide this pre-trial or not. The defense only strategy was this was possession only. That was an opening statement. That was in closing argument. So this error was unquestionably prejudicial to the defense.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Thank you, Mr. Sleeper. The court will take the matter under advisement.